Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Medieval History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Evan Zarkadis, your host, and today I am here with Dr. Eleanor Yanaga, a medieval historian at the London School of Economics, where she specializes in sexuality, propaganda, apocalypticism, urbanity, and empire in the late medieval and early modern periods. While at the same time, she operates the Going Medieval blog and can also be found hosting medieval history programs on History Hit TV. Together with Eleanor, I'm also very excited to welcome Neil Max Emanuel, a creative motion graphic designer, animator, editor, storyboard artist, and a children's book illustrator, to talk about their recent and very exciting work, The Middle Ages, a graphic guide, published in 2021 by Icon Books. Hello, Eleanor and Neil, and welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks so much for having us.
Hello.
No, absolutely. Yeah. From the first time I touched this book, I was very excited, and I really wanted to talk to you and have this conversation on this podcast. So thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you.
Perfect. So I would like to start our conversation with both of you telling us a little bit about yourself. Eleanor, would you like to go first?
Sure. So I suppose that, as you said, you know, I'm a medieval historian by training, which means that, you know, obviously I spend all day long thinking about all of these things. But one of the things that I think we really kind of struggle with as medieval historians a lot of the time is getting our work out to the generalized public. And that was sort of the idea behind this particular book. Part of that is also that I am in my spare time a giant nerd for graphic novels. So it was a really nice kind of opportunity to take, you know, my professional expertise and mix it with something that I just always kind of wanted to try, because it's one thing reading comics all the time and it's another thing to try your hand at making it. But sort of the idea here was that I wanted to get out into the world a really good primer of what I thought people just kind of need as a 101 introduction to medieval history. So it's based on what I teach first years in survey classes, like when I just want to get across sort of like the bedrock foundations and structures of the medieval period, here's what I want you to know. And can we do that with some pictures so that people will hopefully take it on board, I guess. But so, yeah, for me, it's kind of a labor of love, but it comes out of, you know, my own just interest in medieval history as well as comics generally.
Hmm. Awesome. Yes. And how about you, Neil?
I do a whole bunch of stuff which kind of it overlaps, but my goal is always to try and end up doing drawing. that's my rhythm. Basically my raison d'etre, really. That's what I want to be doing. But like, I've got this background as a motion graphic. You mentioned before motion graphics. I work for, I don't know if you know a TV show called Time Team. If you come across that at all, it's quite a famous show in the UK about archaeology. It's like they cover a 3-day dig, and it's a bit of an institution. And I worked for them for about 10 years, doing their motion graphics, and I did a lot of other historical documentaries. So I was kind of steeped in this world. And then, I've done children's books and I've done illustration and storyboarding. And so, other things which really were bringing out my desire to draw. And I kind of got lucky, really. I'm sure we'll go on to sort of talk about it in a bit. But I got the opportunity to work with Icon Books. And actually, one of my big, big passions, again, like it's like you, Eleanor, one of your big passions, is, as you were saying, is comics. Something that I grew up with, that I just was, that's what I read. That's how I understood the world. This was one of those opportunities where I could sort of scratch that itch and start doing like a nice big book with lots of nice comic style cartoon illustrations, but it still was in the world of history, particularly medieval history, because that was an area where I started to get a lot more work. It's just weird how certain things found me. I've done probably more medieval illustration than any other kind of other historical kind of illustration. And I really like the style, because medieval illustration has that kind of look, that cartoon look, It's very iconographic and cartoony and stuff. So, yeah, that's kind of my potted kind of background, really. Just a bit of this, bit of that, bit of this, bit of that. Lots of drawing. I also did drawing for events and businesses. And that was quite good. It's sort of as one of the jobs I did for like 3 or 4 years, where it really helped me to understand workflow, to understand how to kind of take a lot of different items, different illustrations, and kind of tell a larger story. And I've kind of took that experience, and I even implemented it into, I was doing it in our book, Eleanor, Yeah, so there's an area where you have people who illustrate at meetings, and sometimes people call it scribing. So if anyone knows what that is, that's what I did.
Oh, that's so exciting. Yes. And I really want to touch on all of the work that you did and the research. And there's quite a lot of illustrations in there, and they're very, very... what I like to say, you can get the whole story from the illustrations on their own, and then you add the text on top, and it's such it's such a work that you remember after you read. And I have not had a lot of experience with graphic novels. My first one was Mouse.
Wonderful.
For a Holocaust course. And then my second one was your book. And it's opening this world for me. And it's just so exciting. So exciting. And I see this more with academics now. I work a lot with Byzantine studies, and there is this new push to get as close to the public as possible. Mm-hmm. And your book, I believe, does that very well. And that's great to hear how you both got to do this. So how did you come to work together? How did that work out?
We scouted for Neil. So I was in there first. I kind of had the idea for writing this particular book after a friend of mine, Meg John Barker, had written a similar thing for Icon, which was called Queer, A Graphic History. I was walking along with my friends, and we were all talking about how great it was. And my husband said, well, why don't you write something like that? And I was like, that's a great question. Why don't I, right? So off I popped to pitch it and write down my ideas for the book. And then a couple months in, Kira, our editor, our long-suffering and sainted editor, set out looking for various artists to see who we would want to work with. And I got given all of these amazing pictures. And Neil was the one where that was the one where I was like, oh, absolutely, this guy gets it. Because what I really, really wanted in terms of the look and feel was something that actually adhered really closely to medieval art. And having said that, I realize that it's a ridiculous statement to say, medieval art, just 1,000 years of art, no big deal, all of it. But Neil, because he already had his oar in with Time Team and everything, and kind of understood what some medieval aesthetics were, was really, I felt like he would be able to take cues from medieval art, which is what I really wanted him to be able to do. So, I spent a lot of time like digging out picture references. And I was like, I need someone who's going to be able to put this on the page. And I could tell from his portfolio that he would be able to.
Yeah, I was really lucky to work with you too, Eleanor, because I sort of when I joined, we had our first meeting. We met at a nice place called Somerset House, and we were kind of I was introduced to you, Eleanor, and Kira, a lovely editor. It was really nice to meet people who you knew. You could just tell, these are people I can kind of work with and are going to be patient and understanding. It's quite a daunting prospect, actually, to it's like 172 illustrations. And, you know, when you're doing artwork for an author, a writer, who pours their heart and soul to tell stories, there's a certain kind of like pressure to kind of like make artwork that lives up to those words. It can be, when we meet, you have to have a bit of a poker face so you don't look like a complete novice. Oh, I'm really nervous about all of this, but there is a little bit of that going on. But once we started working it, I sort of found that we worked out quite a good workflow, and you mm-hmm. were always available. And I think this is really important for good collaborations, that you were available to actually go through the words with me, rather than expecting me to just take the manuscript away and figure out what things are. Because, although I have worked with a lot of historians over, more than a decade. The nature of how you work with them doesn't really change. How you work with academics and historians and people with a body of knowledge is you ask questions. You are the kind of the everyday person asking. I don't profess to be an expert. That's why we're working together. But what I can do is sometimes be the layperson. The foil, mm-hmm. And that's also useful. I'm sure it was useful for you, Eleanor. So we were able to kind of really communicate, and you were available to be able to kind of steer me, help me with questions, with references, and actually all the extras around the conversations about the material. Because when we talk about paragraphs of the manuscript that you wrote, sometimes it's nice to know the extra bits around it, just as if it was a conversation that you were having with anyone, because there's those little extra things you can filter into the illustrations that they're like, could be like what they call was it an Easter egg? No,
an Easter egg. Yeah.
Yeah, extra little special bits in there.
There are a lot of those there too.
We did that. I think we did embed a lot of unseen stuff, or stuff that's not super significant, but it's there. Like marginellas in ancient manuscripts.
Yeah.
They have a significance, but they're kind of in the margins. That kind of thing.
And I want to say that those little details, because you read the text and you move on to the art, and those little details, I think it's what crack me up most of the time. I'm like, oh, that works so well here.
Oh, thank you.
That's great.
Oh yeah.
So awesome. Yes. So that helps me a lot going into my first kind of like focus question on graphic novels and their importance. And I think we touched just a little bit at the introduction and how mainstream they can get a story out into the popular culture. And we've seen them grow exponentially in the past decade and even more. And I did some research, and there's a lot of historians and scholars out there that call these graphic novels the paradigm shift in how people learn about the past. Mm. How do you see this importance of this graphic novel, for example, for the Middle Ages, being this, I want to say, like, beacon to teaching people that don't really get a lot of background or a lot of teaching on these subjects?
Well, I think that's a really great question, because one of the things that I think is really special about this book, even if I do say so myself, is that with the illustrations, one of the things that we're really able to do is show people that medieval history isn't just like some kind of massively complex, really dull a kind of era that you don't need to look into. You know, one of the things that we're constantly fighting as medievalists is against, you know, this misconception of, you know, the quote unquote dark ages. It's like, oh, this is just a terrible time when everyone rolled in filth and then died of the plague and nothing ever happened and everyone hated science. You know, that's we're up against that kind of caricature and misconception in everything that we do. So one of the things that the pictures are able to do for us, I think, is bring people in and show them, well, actually, this is something that's really fun. This is something that's really fun. It's really interesting. It doesn't have to be just dusty tomes full of Latin that are, you know, that you don't feel connected to. And it also helps to kind of overcome this idea of people in the past as completely inaccessible in and of themselves. You know, like we've got a lot of jokes in the pictures in particular where, you know, we've got punchlines, you know, and we've got people who are kind of living daily lives and showing sort of average things that are happening. And it allows people, I think, to see themselves as a part of that narrative and say, okay, well, it's not just a bunch of kings. It's not just a bunch of popes. It's ordinary people as well. And they've got a rich, difficult, interesting life that I can relate to. And I think that this is one of the things that pictures really effectively does, is bridge that gap between people living hundreds of years ago of being completely remote and that it doesn't have anything to do with you, I guess. One of the things about illustrations is that they're immediate and it helps people see themselves as well.
Yeah, you can sort of hang your eye on a picture sort of thing. I mean, just the vehicle of comics is, again, I'm a big champion of the art form. And as you mentioned Mouse before, Evan, we both really like Mouse.
Love it.
We've got a lot of comics in common that we really appreciate. And Mouse is in our conversations has come up quite a few times. But the power of comics to be able to tell stories is something that I'm kind of pleased that a lot of the world of academia is looking toward, because it's another tool in the arsenal of dissemination. Mm-hmm. The same with, you know, science communication is hugely popular now, so why not history?
Exactly.
I think it's quite an interesting area. I think we're for history, I think it's kind of just starting to catch on, because I think you might have more contemporary stories like Persepolis and Mouse, but not more ancient or older histories. So really, I mean, for us, it was a great opportunity to be able to do like a book like this on such a wide ranging topic, and to have a first year's overview of the major things that were happening within the medieval period, not just in the UK but actually quite a wide chunk of the world, because comics really like is powerful, and to be able to use that for me is personally like for really fulfilling.
Yes, and I should mention that I found your book right after I finished TA for a medieval history first year's course, and I remember saying to myself, oh my god, I wish I had this book to give to the students. They will have been so much more engaged. They will have can imagine the conversations being just so more lively, because it's right on their level in many ways. Not this long primary source text. And again, I thought that through these depictions and through this text that you have produced, historical accuracy, it's actually really, really important in a topic like this. I got a lot out of it, you know, like reading a primary source, for example, by looking one of your sketches So it was a moment for me to say that, you know, maybe I can use this in class, in the future, right? Yes.
Use it in universities and, yeah. and schools.
Well, I am kind of hoping in a way that it will provide a function there, right? Because I think that it's a good way of kind of getting the building blocks in place. And then hopefully, you know, once in undergrads understands, okay, well, this isn't that daunting, I think I've got the basics of it, then you can introduce them to a primary source and go, okay, given this information, how do you think that this fits within everything else? And because I think it's brief enough, and because it's got all of these great pictures, I think it's something that you really can put in front of an undergrad and be like, all right, okay, you've got an idea in your head now, let's go back and say,
yeah,
well, it's more complicated than that, obviously everything is more complicated than that. And I mean, I will tell you what, it is a real challenge if you're like, oh yeah, just 1,000 years of history in, it's like 172 pages.
Yeah.
You know, and the word limits are tight on something like this. But what that kind of allowed me to do was, you know, kill your darlings. So it was a really, what's the most important things? You know, if there's a house fire and you can only get, you know, 100 words per page saved about this particular topic of medieval history, what's it going to be? And that's kind of what you get out of this, I think.
And also, like, I think it makes it really super accessible for non-academics as well to kind of get their sense of, you know, because it's actually helpful for me to remember certain, because even though I made the book, I have referred back to it, just because you kind of, it's quite nice to have there and say, oh yeah, I'd forgotten this bit. Oh, of course it's in the book. So and like I say, I am actually speaking for as a layperson point of view, really, and I find it usually useful. I think it's definitely will appeal to lots of different people, both in academic.
Yes.
I think I find academic texts, because I'm not in that world, for me, it's quite dense and hard to learn about the subject. That's why, you know.
Yeah. Yes, and having a character like Constantine, for example, doing things like we do, like in the 21st century, acting in a particular way that we will act like, we connect a lot.
Yeah.
And you kind of, as Eleanor said, you can start with this and move into something more dense, having these bases build up.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
So let us dive a little bit about the book then. And Eleanor, you brought me a great way to connect to that. You mentioned 1,000 years of history in 100 or so pages. How did you look into this concept of medieval periods? Where did you draw the lines, and how did you approach that for this book?
Yeah, that's a really tough one, right? Because again, brevity is really what it's all about in this one. So, you know, we had to focus on Europe pretty much now. I think that there is still an argument to be made. Obviously, as academics, we're in the middle of really branching out what it is that we mean by medieval. And there's a lot of really exciting work being done on the global. And I do make nods to that. I think, you know, we talk about what's going on, for example, with Genghis Khan. We talk about how the Silk Roads work. We talk about Africa and things like that. But I do think, to an extent, we're still kind of working with the conception of medieval specifically on the terms of Europeanists, and I'm a Europeanist, so, you know, I just had to be like, that's what we're focusing on. But, you know, it makes sense, because the way that I was looking at it is, we're starting with the, you know, supposed quote-unquote fall of Rome, which in the West, which I don't agree with, to be clear. I do not think that Rome fell, nor do I think that any, you know, person at the time would tell you that Rome fell. But, you know, that's kind of the traditional starting point on one end. And then I think what we do a good job of doing on the other end is showing that there isn't really a clear cut way to say, well, we've stopped being medieval and we've hit the modern world. Because, you know, I'm a Bohemia specialist, right? So if you ask me, it's the Hussites. But, you know, I think that it's really easy to also say, hey, the fall of Constantinople, that's the end of the medieval period. Because once you have both centers of Rome fall, that's when you know it's really modern, you know. But hey, like, what about, you know, the beginnings of the kind of like a transatlantic trade? How about that as a starting point? How about, you know, Martin Luther? There are all these things that you could bring up, and we're never going to get to the bottom of that, right? So I think that it was also a really nice opportunity actually to bring that out to audiences themselves and say, look, these are arbitrary, right? You know, the idea of what is medieval is completely constructed by a bunch of historians to make our own lives easier. So, you know, if someone says to you, the fall of Rome, really, most historians are going to be like, I mean, that's not real, is it? That's not a thing, you know? And so if you could start from there, like introducing people to the idea that that's not actually something that would exist in the minds of people at the time, it makes it much easier to kind of get them ready for, I think, the nuance that comes with this. Like, so, I mean, I don't think anybody on earth is going to disagree with me if I tell you that the year, you know, 1175 is medieval, but what do you think about like 1480? What do you think about 485? You know, what do you think about these dates? And that's a matter that we can all kind of take up and we can all debate that. So yeah, I'm afraid that I'm being really Europeanist about it, but I feel like Europeans are the ones who started this. So, you know, we're arguing within those limitations currently.
Sometimes you've got to, if you're asked a question, you got to give it some sort of answer. This used to crop up on the TV show that I was talking about, because experts would hate to be pinned down because of the nuance. And they'd know that they'd have certain other academics going, yes, but what about this? And you haven't considered it. And, you know, but then, you know, if you're doing an interview or you're making a book or you're writing, you have to kind of lay something down. But I think we were able to do it in quite a nice way. In fact, I think the way we dealt with that topic of when did the medieval period end, we were able to kind of use some of your colleagues.
Yeah, we drew in actual colleagues of mine to represent various strands of debate, which is kind of funny because it's not necessarily their own, always their ideas, but I still thought it was quite funny to assign them roles. So I had to ask them all first. You know, I was like talking to, for example, my mate, Carissa Harris, and saying, hey, is it okay if I draw you in for this? This is what I'm going to say that you're saying. And she was like, yeah, I can understand why I would make that argument. And I was like, okay, good enough for me. Good enough, you know, and kind of like moving on from there.
And then it was like,
and oh, you, of course, yes.
Can you get me your, get me their pictures so I know what they look like?
Yes,
so
I'm like a creepily getting photos of them all online. And yes, and then I'm there, of course, to represent for the Czech side of things, obviously. And, you know, the best answer is that the Hussites is when it ends, so.
Well, I haven't heard that version yet, so I was interested to hear that. And I think that ending was what got stuck in my mind after I finished the book. It's such an interesting way to show to an audience about this whole messy debate. Because we tend to think straight lines, periods ends, another begins. And I think the graphics and the text work so well together, and I think I want to use this kind of format to teach others, you know, this is how it really is. It depends on who you ask, and it depends the point of view. So, yes, that was definitely a highlight from the book for me. Perfect. So, as I mentioned, the book, again, as you also said, Eleanor, it has this European-centric point of view, but it has some other elements in there that I thought were amazing that you were able to include in there. And I'm talking about your chapter on the others. And you include in that category things that I, as a TA, did not teach to students, or I did not see in many books when it comes to this introductory knowledge to people that are just getting introduced in this topic. And you mentioned women, of course, sex workers, homosexuals, Jews, heretics, and lepers. And so tell me a little bit about your thought process in this, in this specific chapter on the others, and including these groups in this wider story of the medieval period.
I think that this is, to me, a really important one, because one of the things that you can do, especially if you're sort of taking medieval texts from, you know, their own perspective, and if you just take them on board, then yeah, you know, this is a real history written by the victors. Oh, it's just a bunch of white rich guys walking around and there's nobody else, you know, and that's one of the things that I think really keeps a lot of people at arm's length from talking or thinking about the medieval period, because they just don't see themselves as being represented. This is a thing that I've certainly taught in the past to my undergrads, is thinking about the other and how we kind of frame this. And it often comes up even within early modern courses, because, you know, a lot of things like, you know, the conception of the persecuting society, quote unquote, you know, so you've got the persecuting society, which is really, really attempting to keep, you know, everything on the straight and narrow, you know, as we would say, cishet white guys, and this is the only people who are around the shop. But of course, medieval history is way more complex than that. And indeed, like, the number of prohibitions, the number of rules, the number of things that we see come up over and over again show us that actually these people were all completely present. And I think that's a really important thing to talk about, because, you know, in the first place, you could almost be forgiven for thinking there were never any women in the medieval period. It's like, oh yeah, like, there's a Eleanor of Aquitaine and Joan of Arc, and yeah, there you go, there's the two, right? Those are like the two women you've heard of. And so you have to kind of broaden that out and explain why it is that we came to this particular conception. And I think that's a really interesting story, because it's, you know, drawing on classical ideas. You know, Aristotle is not unforgivable in this, you know, but then, you know, the church picks that up and there are ideas of gender there. You've got to talk about that. I think it's almost impossible to really talk about the way that medieval Europe is set up as well without talking about Jewish people, because it doesn't make any sense from a commerce standpoint. And at the same time, you know, here we are now in the 21st century, and we're still just wading through puddles of anti-Semitism everywhere, right? And people don't really even understand where these terrible tropes come from about Jewish people that we kind of pass around all the time. And it's, you know, the medieval story about Jewish people is so incredibly intrinsic in that, and understanding, you know, why it is that Jewish people were incredibly connected to finance and banking, why it is that this came about. You know, you have to understand usury. You've got to understand how Christian society sets itself up. And I think increasingly we're starting to look and see more queer topics within the medieval period. Obviously, you know, no medieval person ever thought they were queer. They just thought they were, you know, perhaps sodomite. But it's really nice to kind of talk about that too and get that out in front of people and say, okay, well, the way that we describe ourselves or think about our sexuality, our gender, and these things are constantly amorphous and changing all the time. So here is a great way of looking at that. And I think also I always try to get sex workers in there as well, because, you know, it's one of my areas of expertise. And I just think they're so interesting, like, especially from the point of view of if you want to talk about women's history, because here is one of the only groups of quite they're not always impoverished, but here's a group of impoverished women who are kind of making their own way in what is very much a man's world. And it's a great way of studying what the options are for women of the lower classes. And that's what really interests me about them. And I think that also sometimes people just think that, like, oh yeah, sex work, that's something that we invented just now. And it's like, well, no, not exactly. And I think talking about lepers is always really, really interesting for tons of religious reasons. But so I bring up all these particular groups because these are people that you see come up time and time again. It doesn't matter where you go, you know, in medieval Europe, unless it's kind of like post the expulsion of the Jews in Europe, you're going to come into contact with all of these groups, right? These are going to be people who are around the shop and who are an ordinary part of everyday life, but they think about themselves differently. Society has constructed itself in such a way to other them and kind of keep them as outcasts while at the same time requiring them, right? Because the stories of all this is like, well, you know, people are still going to have leprosy no matter how poorly you treat them. And oh, also look, this is an opportunity for rich people to pat themselves on the back for how nice they are to people with leprosy. You know, women, turns out half the population, who knew? Jewish people, it's, well, you're still going to need money, Len, aren't you, homeboy? So like, here you go. Here are the people who are doing it. And, you know, sex work is considered absolutely necessary. So it doesn't matter how you feel about it, right? And that is one thing that I think is really that we have in common with the medieval period is we still loved other people, but they're still there all the time. And they're still kind of weaving themselves in and out of the fabric of our society. And I think it's so important to talk about social constructs like othering, how they work, and what how we bring them into being, because fundamentally social constructs are real, but we constructed them. So until we see the history of them and we really confront the fact that these things are changing all the time, we're not going to unmake them. So I just think it's really, really important to have this conversation where there are always these, you know, for lack of a better word, flukes in what is the idealized, you know, if you ask Thomas Aquinas, what's his ideal world look like? None of these people are going to be involved, but here they are, and they're still as much an important part of medieval life as anybody else.
I think one of my favorite pages is where we were able to kind of have that parallel between, you know, certain groups like people who have HIV and mm-hmm. lepers from the past. You know, I think that was a win picture to just have that as part of our body of work. And also like another reasons I sort of really enjoyed working with Eleanor is because you kind of use a feminist lens, I think, to appraise and just, you know, it's not just a patriarchal kind of narrative, and we're able to kind of do things which have maybe haven't been I can't really say this for sure, you guys would know better than me, but really just maybe take a slightly different look at these kinds of people, how they get treated, and to tell people about them in a much more aware modern way, I think, you know.
Yeah.
And what were you looking, Neil, when you received the text? Just about the others now, but that section, what were you looking for when you were thinking about your illustrations?
I was looking for a lot of references. so, you know, for me, imagery is obviously at the fore of my, you know, I need to know how I should be drawing certain people. So we like, for example, Jewish hats, you know, trying to make sure I was able to kind of capture the essence of it, but also not buy into too, it's quite tricky because when you're illustrating the others, you don't want to fall into tropes. I mean, like I've got a Jewish background. My family's Jewish and, I mean, I'm a secular atheist sort of person, but you know, I've got a very sort of a stake in not portraying Jewish people in a derogatory way, you know, in a positive way, especially historically. But you know, but there's some things that you might want to kind of get is like, so, you know, there's different ways that Jews were represented and just trying to find the balance between honoring how the artwork was portrayed without making it kind of insulting. I'm talking about the others here. But there were lots of like opportunities to embed. I mean, like I remember when we were doing drawing prostitution and prostitutes, night workers and all that kind of stuff, that you know, the scarves were black and white striped, you know, there were details that needed to be included, and you know, is I would need to also find examples of this artwork. Sometimes it would be like I get a few references from you, Eleanor, but then sometimes I'd need to dig a bit deeper, and I sort of like started to build up, add to my database. I already had a database of medieval imagery that whenever I work on medieval projects, I kind of like just add to it. So like animals, what, you know, I've got a folder called cats. So I've now got a folder called owls because, you know, there was a few times that I needed to draw owls. So yeah, it's kind of really like just trying to find good references that I could riff off of and hybridize. Sometimes I'd take a couple of different references and conglom them together to make a hybrid image. That's how you can kind of I could tailor it to our whims, our needs, but just take a little bit from here, a little bit from there, a little bit from there. So all these like three or four different locations, different illustrative periods, perhaps, or but make it one picture. So I've done that quite a few. I mean, that's one of my tricks. I don't know if you call it tricks, but like one of the things that I've done it with. It's a funny thing because I remember when I once had to draw Vladdy Dracul. In my head, I had an image that didn't exist for some reason. I think I'd seen three or four different images from the past. One was a painting. One was, I'd seen one in a comic. It just didn't exist. So I think I found all the images that I'd seen through my research, and then I made the picture in my head that I thought existed.
I love that.
Which is like perfect. And so we did a lot of that. There are a few pages where I was. I've got to go through the book again. It just escapes me. But one of the kings we were drawing was like, there was like three or four different representations. And sometimes another interesting thing when you're trying to draw kings is sometimes you find paintings from different periods and they look totally different because when they're young, they don't have beards. And then when they're old, they have beards. And a lot of old beardy kings look pretty much similar, but it's quite nice sometimes just to go. So it's like, well, which one do you go for? Which one would you represent? And usually I go for the one that is maybe the archetype, just because it's maybe going to be maybe more recognizable. So, you know, if you were like talking about Henry VIII, I know it's a different period, but Henry VIII, then, which would it be, a young Henry VIII or would it be the older sort of more portly Henry VIII? It'd probably be the latter, so people know who it is. But then there could be a reason why you might go for the younger, just to be a bit more subversive. Maybe we're talking about, like, because people don't talk about the young Henry VIII as much as they do the old Henry, the one who got married. I don't know. There's all these sorts of things flying through my head when I'm drawing these things. So it's just very similar for the others that you know, it's like, oh, how can we subvert some of the pictures from maybe what we expect? We should be doing some things which are actually a bit unexpected, turning things on that, turning the situations on its head, and you know, looking at the cup upside down rather than right side up, all that kind of stuff.
Oh my god, yes, that's sounds like a lot of work. Yes. The last thing on that section, I think it's a section that you're not going to see a lot in survey courses, especially for freshmen, for example, for college or for anybody that just starts to learn about these topics. So I thought that as you mentioned, Neil, it was an important section for my perspective to be well represented if it's somebody's first time looking and learning about this. Yes, and again, I really like that it was included. That it was included.
I'm so glad to hear you say that, because that's my absolute baby in terms of what got in there. So,
yeah, no, yes. that was a win. I think there are quite a few pages in there. Really enjoy. I enjoyed drawing the nuns in love. That was like a jigsaw puzzle that I was drawing there. It's really
that one's really gorgeous. So incidentally, fun. Yeah, you're one of the Jewish communities too. Is one of my favorite illustrations, where you've got you took a really great picture of a bunch of Jewish scholars debating, and then we've got a map of major Jewish communities on top of that. And I just think it's really gorgeous.
Yeah, that's a good example actually of like, you know, how do I depict? Because what we used for, I think, the icons, I've got to double check this, but I think this is what I did. So what we did for the sort of the locator icons of the different Jewish settlements or places where they, you know, cities that they were living in, I needed to make icons, and it seemed like a Star of David icon would make sense.
Yeah, that's the one. Yep.
But again, you don't want to do it in a way that is, I mean, like you can do these things in a way that's tasteless, like, you know, the yellow stars stern from that the Jews had to wear during the Nazi period. So there are things that, like, how do we do this so that it's kind of, you know, the tone is right for this. I mean, again, I enjoyed that. That was we that was a pretty much a map page. So it's quite nice to kind of mix up how we portrayed maps come up a lot in my career. There were quite a few maps within the book. And I think we started to nail the style of the map. And I think that really helped. But sometimes, you know, it's like, how can we make the maps fit the pictures more? Maybe get the maps not just being maps, but actually part of the picture. Sometimes they're telling the story, so there'll be a. I think there's is it the Normans? There's some kind of invasion happening, and then
yeah, we have one of the Normans because we had to show everywhere they went.
And then
which was everywhere.
Jesus. I was able to introduce a Jesus walking on water, saying I'm not getting involved. Something like that. Does that make sense?
yes, I think that was with the religious section. Yes, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. So for me, I'm like, oh, I get to draw Jesus walking on water.
So something you don't get to do very often. I'm questioning. Yes. Well, that's awesome. So on your part, Eleanor, what kind of research went on your end putting these pieces together? Because I want to guess that it was hard trying to get all of this knowledge.
It really, really was hard trying to get everything in. So what I sort of set out to do in the first place was establish, I suppose, what I would call the structures or the highlights of the medieval period. So I had to talk about kind of changes in power structures. Talking about the church and its rise and how it kind of changed over time. There were certain things like monasticism comes and goes. So I've got to introduce the concept of monasticism and then reintroduce later on the mendicants, things like that. And so it was kind of the first thing that was the process of picking down what are like the common threads that really unite this entire period together, because we can't just say, oh, it's the bit when between Rome, like that's not fair. So, you know, if we do say that this is one amalgamated timeline, then what are the things that make it so? And so it was a process of elimination from there. But then there are also sort of things that I think really pick up from each other, you know. So, for example, you can talk about the Vikings, and then that when you come to the Normans later, which you need a bunch of maps for, then that's kind of like a natural progression of those things. Because, you know, as we know, our Norman friends had quite a lot of, you know, a Viking in there as well, which set them up. So there are, I think, these kind of constant callbacks as you move through the medieval period that help you help to remind you of those things. Now, I also had to make sort of conscious decisions about not including some things. So, you know, when you're talking about, for example, the Crusades, we leaned really heavily into talking about the First Crusade because, you know, that's sort of like the most interesting one. You just can't say, all right, and now it's time to talk about every single crusade, because now you've got a comic book that's just about the Crusades. That's it. Congratulations, you know. You'll never catch your girl doing the Crusades. It's not going to happen. What we had to do that is say, okay, well, here's the Crusade and by the First Crusade. And by the way, the reason that we're going so heavily into the First Crusade is this is the only successful one. And every single other one is just a process of trying to kind of like recapture that grandeur. So we refer to the fact that other Crusades are happening. That's something that we bring up, but we never dwell on it again in that same way. So because there just isn't enough room. But we will, for example, spend some time, you know, we talk about Charlemagne and then we talk about the Ottonians. And then we kind of talk about, you know, the Holy Roman Empire as it gets set up. So, you know, there are certain points that you have to flip through. And then it was a matter of doing things like, oh God, then I had to really look into the Ottonians. Oh no. You know, and even as for someone like me, who's a Holy Roman Imperial specialist, I was like, oh really? You know, and had to like go digging around in there. So, but of course there's fun things within there. It's like, everybody likes the walk to Canossa. You got to talk about that. So it's like, what are also going to be these stories that set you up for like, the biggest, most fun stories that we can pin to bring an audience in as well. Because you know, everyone want to hear about an emperor walking around barefoot in the snow and getting like locked out by a pope. That's a very funny story. Yeah. That's a great story that really encapsulates things. So it's like, even if I did have to figure out a lot of stuff about Henry the Fowler that I wasn't necessarily really thought I'd sign up for, it paid off in the long run. So yeah, there's a lot of kind of reading around things where I have, you know, everyone's got that 101 kind of, sure, the medieval, yeah, you know, I'm a medievalist. Yeah, I know about that. But, you know, I had to go in and really look in more detail about those things so that I could make sure that I was treating them well enough that they make sense in the overall narrative, if that makes sense.
Yes. And I thought there were some chapters in there that were more like heavy in text or maybe mm-hmm. or trying to cram as much as possible, and some others were more like flowing I'm assuming that was part of that as well.
Exactly, because it would sort of like, if you put someone through, I think if you put especially your average reader through a really dense information thing, you then need to like carry that flow on narratively. You need to give them a break, you know, like let them have a little period where they just understand, okay, all of that has kind of settled in my mind and now we're moving on to the next thing. Here's how we move on. You really kind of have to establish an ebb and flow with things like that, yeah. Because it just cannot be information. But unfortunately, at the same time, there's going to be times when you just have to say, here's a bunch of information about the Crusades. Sorry, guys. You know, that's just, there's no way of getting around it. And so a big part of the process is picking and choosing those moments, picking and choosing where it is you go all in on information.
And this comes back to like the fact that we're doing it as a comic book, or you know, it's an a hugely illustrated book that we're able to kind of filtrate some of the information into certain flows across the page, so it isn't so dense. Also, that there is there's the beat and rhythm of the story telling through words, but there's also the same. Or a complementary, narrative running with the pictures and the way the pictures have been designed across the page and sort of leads you along. So, I mean, that was something we worked with quite a lot in our in our sessions, was composition to make sure that it did make sense with the way it was quite hard thing to do, because I'd kind of take paragraphs and I'd have to kind of guess how big those paragraphs would actually be in the printed book. And I think I got it slightly wrong, but basically generally we were able to kind of fit the pictures, not around, but integrate the pictures with the words, so that it wasn't, they weren't two separate entities. They kind of would hopefully work together, and occasionally, you know, really like embed some of the words as part of the picture.
Yes, and I think that's like one of the better qualities of doing this once again. We're coming close to our time, and I want to get to really important questions for me. And in the last line of the book, for better and worse, the Middle Ages are still very much a part of our world. Ignoring them means ignoring ourselves. We can do better. Can you explain this a little more?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that I think about in terms of the historiography of medieval history is that we tend to ignore it for specific and often like colonial reasons, right? You know, we ignore the medieval period because we are really invested in telling a story of society, quote unquote, or the world, quote unquote, is better when it's being run by really violent, you know, colonial imperial groups that, surprise, surprise, run on the backs of slavery. You know, we're really invested in telling that story where it's like, Rome was great. Oh, everything was wonderful in Rome. We was 40% of the Italian peninsula enslaved? Sure. But wow, the Colosseum, what a nice time. And, you know, I've literally had people in real life tell me that it was better to be a slave in Rome than live anywhere else on earth at that time and be free.
Oh my God.
Which, you know, I think that all of these slaves who were constantly having revolts would argue against. But there's a reason that our idea of history collectively is there was Greece and then there was Rome, something, 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 Magna Carta, something, 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 something. Oh, Columbus has discovered, quote unquote, the New World. Look at that. And then, you know, we establish some more massive slave empires. So we ignore medieval history because it's inconvenient. And it doesn't tell a story where Europeans are violently dominating the rest of the world. It tells a story where Europeans are like hanging out, guys, and just kind of like muddling along. And well, I mean, I say muddling along. Actually, you know, it's a time of real, you know, intellectual vigor. There's a lot of things that come out of the medieval period just in terms of inventions, like let alone philosophy, that are absolutely staggering. But the point is, there are perfectly wonderful, complex and connected lives to be had in the medieval period, but we don't tell that story because it's not a story where white people dominate the world. And the minute white people do dominate the world, then, oh, hey, suddenly, hey, history is good again. But we still have the structures from the medieval period are very much a part of our lives. Like, you know, we still really like to indulge in othering, for example. Mm. We still really do kind of look to these same power structures. You know, here, you know, Neil and I live in the UK. We still have a queen, you know? Like, we still have these things that we're living under here, which yeah, it's easy to forget about. So
got a jubilee coming up, haven't we?
We sure do. So, you know, oh, we're hoping for a couple of days off, right? Hey,
oh God. Yeah, we've also got a prince in disgrace.
We got
a
prince in disgrace. We got it all, right? So, you know, the ignoring medieval history and acting as though, you know, that's just a long time ago and you don't have to pay attention to it. And also it was bad. It's a political choice that lets us off the hook for our own bad decisions and, you know, the own choices that we're still choosing to make as we go along. So I think until we really confront medieval history and the way that our past has shaped us, we're not admitting how it is that we got to the point that we're at now.
Yes, that is something that, as also a medieval historian in training, it's something that, you know, such a tough topic to really think about and you know, put out there. So
when we were making the book, it was basically through the Trump administration.
Yeah.
So he does pop up.
he's in the book too.
Yeah.
So that was like, you know, we were able to draw some analogies, you know, that's the thing.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I thought that page, that's page 174. I bookmarked it. it was, I think it hit home as well, cause that's where the last line is as well. And you have this, modern concepts and then, medieval ones and you contrast them. Mm. And yes, that's, yeah. All the money, as I say, that's right there. Well, perfect. One fun question now. Which one was your favorite part in the book? Either sketches or topic?
Okay, so I've got an answer for both of these. So my favorite topic is others, but my favorite sketch is it's the Vikings one where Neil's got this really great river that goes, I think it goes over three pages. So it's like you turn the page and the river's still going and you've got a Viking ship that's going along the river. And I just think it's so gorgeous. And we worked really hard on that layout. And I think it really, really came together. So that's my number one picture. But my number one topic is always going to be talking about the little guys. I just love it.
I think I'm the same. I think the others, in terms of topic. But one of the things that I kind of like, I was one of my proudest moments in the book is actually not pictures. I got a chance to do a poem about Abelard. I don't even know if I'm saying that right, Elena. But,
yeah, that's right.
Peter
Look, he's
Abelard.
Learning.
I know. Get me. But I got to do some poetry and some words. So that's my writing contribution to the book. And I don't think you were expecting that at all, Elena.
No, like, I wasn't. No, and so, I really like that.
And it's a strange topic to do a poem about, to be honest, but
I simply love making fun of Peter Abelard. So, you know, that's my hobby.
That's kind of how I felt. Yeah.
Call me St. Bernard of Clairvaux because I'm out here making fun of Abelard.
He sounds
that's a medieval history joke, right?
So, yeah, I think I quite enjoy drawing. You know, also, I got to draw Neil deGrasse Tyson and
yes,
Stephen
yes.
Hawking. So, yep. You know, those that was quite nice too.
those are the funny tiny details that you kind of have to pay attention to them. It's like, is that really him?
Yeah.
Well, that's great. My favorite one, it's not anything big. It was just a little tiny one talking about Charlemagne and being crowned the emperor, and I studied Byzantium, and you have this awesome sketch where in the West he's Count Emperor of the Romans, and in the East the Empress is in fume. Oh, yeah. I'm the Emperor of the Romans, and I thought that sketch encompassed everything that I studied in the past years.
Yes, I absolutely love to hear that. Yeah, I thought that one was really quite funny because I'm obsessed with pointing out, I'm always like, Eastern Rome. That's what I always have to say. I'm a real nerd about it. I'm like, no, Eastern Rome. No, we're not saying yes. Byzantium today. So.
Yes, big. That's another topic, yes.
It was nice to draw, like, as Eleanor, you were saying, like, to draw more women in the book as well.
Yeah.
So I think that was like, again, it's like, oh, you know, and actually that's quite hard to find female references through. It's harder. So to kind of see what the clothes were like and what the, you know, for the period. So yeah. And what certain status period people, you know, if you're drawing an empress, you know, what would she have looked like in that period? You're more likely to find maybe emperors and stuff. So that's kind of cool. Yeah. I'm glad you liked.
Absolutely, like, yes.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, Eleanor and Neil, we've taken a lot of your time, and I thank you very much for that. I would like to ask you the last question before you go. What are you up to nowadays? Do you have any interesting projects that you're working on?
I do. So I am just in the last stages of editing a trade book, which is going to be out on Allen and Unwin next year. It is called The Once and Future Sex. It is a dissection of women's roles in medieval society and what that means now. And also coming up on Icon the year after. I am doing a little work with my friend Sara Oberg Stradal, and we are talking about myths about the Renaissance in that one, so that should be good.
Ooh, cool. Yes. Cool. Perfect.
I've actually been working on Time Team again. They kind of so the TV show ran for, like, I don't know, 1994 in the UK on Channel 4, all the way up to about, I think the last show probably went out around about 2013, 2014. And so it was in the public consciousness. Anyway, they started again up through Patreon. So they're doing it more through, like, YouTube at the moment. So we actually made two brand new shows last year, and I'm working on the graphics currently for one of them. So that's one of the things I'm doing. And then, yeah, I've got a few other comics I'm sort of working on, again, through kind of from an academic point of view, like taking academic work, but not history. It's actually more to do with dementia and dance. And so it's a slightly different kind of area working. And I've got another one as well, which is to do with perspective. So it's kind of, again, it's like sort of like music therapy, psychology. So they're quite niche areas in a way, but I get to draw fun pictures actually that you know, are quite strange and abstract. So yeah.
Well, that's exciting, and best of luck for whatever you have going on for the year. Again, thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it, and take care.
Thanks. No so problem. Much
take care.